Well, good afternoon. Are we getting to the point in the week now where we're getting close to the I need a coffee IV stage? I hope not. But lots of Joe being consumed, at least from my part. We're just going to go through some quick reviewing here. Chapter headings and what we've talked about. Chapter 1, Hannah asked God, speaking of reliance, she had the opportunity to rely on other things to try to deal with her barrenness. She could have gone to the Asherah, the false gods that were fertility goddess. Chapter 2, worship, wickedness, and warning. We talked about respect as it was not demonstrated by Hophni and Phinehas. Samuel heeded God. Chapter 3, receptivity. Now we're at chapter 4, rabbit foot theology. And the R word that I'm using there is retreat. And in chapter 5, God defends himself. I'm calling that retread. Chapters 4, 5, 6, and 7 do have structure. And we'll just look at that briefly here. A, Battle of Aphek, which is a Philistine victory. Chapter 4, verses 1b to 11. B, Ark captured and exiled. 4, 12 to 22. C, Ark and Philistia, plagues, 5, 1 to 12. We'll read chapter 4, make some comments about it, think about a few things, and then move into chapter 5, similar to what we did yesterday. Chapter 4, beginning at the second part of verse 1. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines and encamped beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped in Aphek. Then the Philistines put themselves in battle array against Israel, and when they had joined battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. And when the people had come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. I failed to mention that keep your eyes peeled in this chapter for the Ark of the Covenant or the Ark of the Covenant of God. Verse 5, "And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. Now when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, 'What does the sound of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?' Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So the Philistines were afraid, for they said, 'A God has come into the camp.' And they said, 'Woe to us! For such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us! Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods?' These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Be strong and conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. And every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Also the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Then a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line the same day and came to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. Now when he came, there was Eli sitting on a seat by the wayside watching, for his heart trembled for the Ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told it, all the city cried out. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, "What does the sound of this tumult mean?" And the man came quickly and told Eli. Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were so dim that he could not see. Then the man said to Eli, "I am he who came from the battle, and I fled today from the battle line." And he said, "What happened, my son?" So the messenger answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has been a great slaughter among the people. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured. Then it happened. When he made mention of the ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was with child due to be delivered, and when she heard the news that the ark of God was captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed herself and gave birth, for her labor pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the women who stood by her said to her, "Do not fear, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer, nor did she regard it. Then she named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." Father, thank you for your word that we have so freely given to us. We pray that you would bless our time together, open understanding, help us to receive those truths and lessons that you delight to share with us. We pray in your name. Amen. Right away, we're up against some people and places. If you happen to have your map, very basic map on the back of the pop quiz sheet, and you'd like to fill it out, I know you could just probably turn to the back of your Bible and look at your maps, but there's something about engaging with paper that may help to put it in your mind. And besides, if you're a teachable person, you love to do that kind of thing. That's just, what can I learn? How can I learn it? So what we have here, we have Beersheba in the south, which is probably on the northern edge of the desert. The Negev desert stretches quite far south, so it's not really inhabitable, but it is part of Israel. So we're zeroing in more on the central part of Israel, Jerusalem being just west of the top of the Dead Sea there. And then if you go north and west, even of Shiloh, there's where they think Ebenezer probably was. Some of these are guesses, because when you're doing archaeology and you're digging up pottery and all that, it doesn't come with labels, you know, from Ramah. And in fact, if the archaeologists do work here in 1,000 years, they probably think they'd found China, right? Everything would say made in China. Aphek would be close to Ebenezer. Obviously, the army of Israel was in one place near Ebenezer, and the army of the Philistines was in Aphek or near there. Then you have the Philistine city of Ashdod, which is along the coast, pretty much directly due west of Jerusalem. Just south of there, also along the coast, is Ashkelon. Just south of that is Gaza. Then you have Gath, which is due east, pretty much, of Ashkelon, maybe a little north. And Ekron, which is east and a little north of Ashdod. So those five cities make up what's called the Pentapolis. Penta meaning what? Five. Polis, city. So the five cities. Remember in the New Testament it talks about Decapolis. Deca being 10, the 10-city region. This is each city is pretty much its own city-state, but they work together as a confederation. And so that's what you have there with them. So you have these various places there on the map. Who were the Philistines? Well, they were apparently a seafaring people. They'd been around for quite a while. They inhabited the southwestern part of Israel. They were never entirely conquered, at least not up until this time where we're reading here. From what I've read, if you've heard of the term Palestine, it comes from the word, apparently, Philistine. So their influence is still with us today. You still have today in this south Western region, you have what's called the Gaza Strip, so there's that influence from probably originally the town of Gaza, it was Philistine. And of course you still have a ongoing Palestinian slash, not Israelite, but Israeli pressure going on. So in some ways you might be able to say the Philistines never went away. I'm not directly tying Philistines with modern day Palestinians, but I'm saying there's interesting connections that The Philistines definitely left their mark. So we have this city of Ebenezer and Aphek. What's interesting is Israel camps beside this place. The meaning of the name, which will crop up a little later, well, tomorrow. What does Ebenezer mean? Does anybody remember what the name of Ebenezer stands for? Up to this point, God has helped us. So that's where Israel's camping. They're camping beside, up till now, God has helped us. It's a little ironic because we know the story. And close by are the Philistines. It says that the Philistines put themselves in battle. This is verse 2, a battle array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. So we recognize that warfare, styles of warfare have changed and evolved over the years. And so best as I can understand from the text here, it seems like each army had their own base camp where they set up tents, cooking pots, campfires and all that probably. And then there was a common battlefield where they met together to decide who's the winner today. So end of the first day, we see that it's Philistines 1, Israelites 0. Bad day for the Israelites. So the people came back to the camp. Verse 3, the elders of Israel, the leaders, I don't know if they were the officers or who the elders were exactly, but they were the ones in charge. They were the ones that were doing a lot of the strategizing, thinking about what needed to happen to make sure they didn't have another bad day like they just had. And so they got to talking. Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? They're doing good post-game analysis. I'm not trying to reduce this to just a game. Obviously, it was people's lives in the balance, but there's, you know, obviously conflict back and forth here. How can we turn this situation around? What went wrong today? Well, apparently God wasn't with us. Okay, well, they asked a good question. They got a good answer. It's true. You know, every time God was with them, they were on the winning side. wasn't that God was on their side necessarily. They were on God's side and it all worked out well. But then it's possible to ask the right questions, get a right answer, and then come up with a wrong strategy. Have you ever seen that happen? That does happen. And they decided that the best thing to do, since God must not be with us, well, then we need to bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord into our midst. We need to make this happen. We know that that's the symbol of the dwelling place of God. And so, this is going to be our ticket. This will be our answer. The red flag here in this verse should be in how they speak of the ark. You notice this here where they say, let us bring the ark of the covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies. Uh-oh. Things just took a wrong turn here. We're focusing on an item now. And they thought that they had a solution. So that's what they did. They sent people to Shiloh to bring the ark, and they brought it into the camp. And wow, there was a powerful rally. There was a great shout went up. In fact, so much so that the earth shook. I want to hear the earth shake. Earth shake? Earth shake? More? Okay. And I'll say, yeah! Yeah! Okay. Well, we got one that's excited. We're going to lose if that's all we have. Okay. One. We're going to do it in three. One, two, three. Yeah! Okay. Now, this has to work together. It wasn't just a shout. It wasn't just a rumble. It was the two together. I mean, that's rumbling and shouting. So, okay, let's get the rumbling going. Let's go. Okay. Then one, two, three. Yeah! Okay. God is with us. This is great. We're going to take these guys on. I mean, they were pumped. It was a great time to be a part of Team Israel. Meanwhile, in the camp next door, the Phillies weren't feeling too good. Okay? Because they heard what was going on, and somehow their spies, their scouts got the report. And they realized that Israel had pulled an atomic bomb. I mean, they were completely discomfited. They could hardly believe that Israel would do this type of thing. It had never happened before that they knew of anyway. And so they weren't just afraid. They were downright scared. It's interesting how they talk about this. They actually talk about the history of Israel. And they seem to remember God's works even better than God's people themselves. Isn't that fascinating? You know, these are the mighty gods that brought plagues on Egypt, and now they're here. So, it's interesting how that happens even today. I'm thinking of things like the Crusades. The Muslims have a long memory. Remember I said we tend to have very short histories, our culture and our generation. Usually it starts with the day we were born. That's how far back our history goes. You talk to Muslims, I've had an opportunity to talk to them in London, because there are over 2 million Muslims in England, over 1 million in London. They are targeting London so that if they can take it on, they can take on the rest of Europe. There's now a Muslim mayor there. They have designs for all of the whole world. But anyway, you talk to them, I mean, their memory goes way back to the 1000s and 1100s when the Crusades were taking place. I'm not even sure how many Crusades there were. What, three? Something like that. But they have a long memory. So anyway, we've got these long odds, at least in the Philistine eyes. And what's that make them do? Does it make them give up? Not at all. Makes them pound each other on the back and say, look, we can do this. Come on. I don't know what they said to each other, but maybe things like, come on, fight like a Philistine man, not like an Israelite woman. You got this. We can do it. We're winners, not slaves. Fight hard, die free. Say no to slavery. Knock out the Israelites. I don't know. I'm not very good at rallies, you know? We need somebody to come up with a good rally cry. Anyway. So, which camp had the better rally? Was it over there in Ebenezer, or was it in Aphek? Well, next day, they go out for battle. And it says 30,000 Israelites are cut down. Final score. Philistines 2, Israelites 0. Tally after the second battle. 30,000 dead. One lucky charm gone. And two Lucky Charm attendants dead. Now you understand what I'm saying, I trust, when I talk about this matter of rat at foot theology or Lucky Charm. I'm not minimizing what the Ark was and what it stood for. I'm talking about it in the terms that the Israelites were treating it. They were treating it as this amazing talisman. If we just have this thing, everything will go our way. And we will force God to act on our behalf. Obviously, that's not the way it went. So you see this man of Benjamin, from the tribe of Benjamin, running that very same day. So obviously, wherever Ebenezer and Aphek were exactly, it was close enough to run there the same day to Shiloh and carry the awful news that he had. You can see that this chapter has a lot of tumult, because you have first the first defeat, then you have this wonderful rally and counter rally, and then you have the messenger showing up at Shiloh, and the cry of the city is going up. This chapter just has tremendous ups and downs, mainly downs. So, possible that this man ran as many as 20 miles from the battlefield to Shiloh. Eli is sitting along the road, keeping watch, even though he's blind. That's sort of the ironic part of it. You know, keeping his ears out for what might happen, what might be going on. The messenger apparently goes right past him. He doesn't see him, of course. And it's only when he hears the cry of the city that he's alerted to something going on. Now, even though we talk about rabbit foot and talismans and stuff, I really believe Eli knew it was something more than that. Because you see, the text says that his heart was trembling for the ark. He was responsible for that thing. And I don't know if he had a choice or not as to whether it was taken away. Josephus says that Eli had already passed on leadership to his son Phinehas, and so he was more of a retired priest than he was maybe the priest in charge, but it may not have been his choice for the ark to go into battle. But anyway, he's way overweight, he's filled with anxiety, wondering what's happening to the ark that he was supposed to be responsible for. And it's interesting that we find him in the end in the very same position that we found him in the beginning. You remember that? We found him sitting by the temple. And of course, in that case, he misjudged Hannah and what she was doing. Just has a way of tying Eli's life together. He was a man who sat. A man that in so many ways was indifferent. And we wish that he would have been a lot more proactive. There was something unusual about him, and that was the roles that he carried. You remember what roles he was in? There were two main roles that he carried. We didn't necessarily talk about this. This was more something you'd have to deduce from reading or other places. He was the high priest, but it was unusual that the high priest would also be a judge. As far as I know, he was the only one that carried those two positions together. You have multiple judges, of course, over the course of several hundred years, but I think Eli's the only one that carried those two positions at the same time. We see that once the divine dominoes start toppling, there's no stopping them. God had prophesied judgment at least twice, once through the unnamed prophet, secondly through Samuel. And once that started going, there was no stopping. So not only are there thousands of men dead on a battlefield and one older man dead by the roadside, now we have a woman going into labor and toward her own premature death, perhaps premature labor, I don't know. There's life in the midst of death, but the news is anything but happy. This boy that's being born is being born into a very sad world. Someone has noted that he was deprived of his grandfather, uncle, father, and mother all in a single day, the day of his birth. How would you celebrate your birthday if you had started out that way? Might change the celebration to a different day, right? Well, it gets worse. And the worst part is the name that his mother gave him. Ichabod. Imagine any mother naming their child Ichabod. That's terrible. Hey, Icky, it's time for supper. Or is it Itchy? I don't know what the pronunciation is, but you know, just not right. Anyway, there are some really bad baby names out there. Ichabod's not the only one. I actually have a name I got all these years ago. Bad Baby Names. It's the name of the book. Subtitle is The Worst True Names Parents Saddled Their Kids With, and you can too. And this guy went back through census records of the last 200 years or so to find what he thought were the oddest, strangest, worst names you could imagine. Some of them aren't too bad. I mean, we've got some really interesting ones going around today, so, you know, we're keeping the trend going in some ways, but how about this name? Feverbender. Well, no. Hysteria Johnson. Not sure if that's a boy's name or a girl's name. Fat Meat Fields. And worse, that was a girl's name. Some people went for the biblical names. Now, just because it's in the Bible doesn't mean that it's a good name for your child. I'll just share that little tidbit. I know some of you girls maybe are already making lists of names for your children. And my wife did that. Hey, you want to know one of the amazing things? At the top of her list for boys? Brandon. I think that's pretty cool. Anyway, that was long before we met. Anyway. A boy named Goliath Kaiser, and he had a brother named David. I think some of these parents are just cruel. I don't know. Ecclesiastes Pate. And then there was a girl named Merry Christmas. I know an older lady, her husband's a professor at the school that I attended, the Bible school, Bible college, and she doesn't like her name, but she likes to tell the story of years ago. There was a man talking to her, and she was explaining to him that she really didn't care for her name. Well, he didn't know what her name was. He said, well, it can't be as bad as Gertrude. And she said, but that's what my name is. We just called her Gertie. So anyway, yeah, she's a great lady. And you know, it doesn't matter if you have a name that's a little off or a little weird, whatever. You can actually rise above it. You can live better than what your name is. We were talking yesterday about how Phineas had, his namesake, the person he was probably named after, Aaron's grandson, was a great guy. He honored God, God in turn honored him. But Phineas lived completely 180 degrees differently and wrecked that name, at least with his life. What's fascinating is people have been named Ichabod. Can you believe this? There was actually a minister in the early 1800s into the late 1800s, or mid-1800s, who was named Ichabod Spencer. I mean, obviously he wasn't a minister when he was named, but he was born in Rupert, Vermont. And later he went to the Second Presbyterian Church in New York City, or in Brooklyn, and was a pastor there. And he pastored there 20-some years. He made approximately 800 pastoral visits, or at least either went out or had people come in to visit, every year, on average, for the 2+ decades that he was a pastor in Brooklyn. And more than that, he recorded virtually every visit that he had, and he had volumes upon volumes of accounts of interactions with people. And they took 77 of those, I think 20,000 accounts, and produced this 2-volume set, which was reprinted, called A Pastor's Sketches. And right here on the cover, you can see it says Ichabod Spencer. That was the guy's name. But this man was known as the Bunyan of Brooklyn in the mid-1800s. People back then would hardly believe, probably, that virtually no one today would know him or know his name. But he was that well known and that well used by God. So I'm using that as an illustration to say, no matter what your name is, we can either live up to and beyond, or we can deviate quite far from the name that's been given to us. All right, we're thinking about this chapter. And what we could learn from it. I'd like us to think a little bit about symbols. What is a symbol? How would you define a symbol?
A special character that means something specific.
Okay. Special character that means something specific. So it's pointing to something, or it's, Anyone else? Okay, word picture. Mm-hmm. Definition that I found, something used for or regarded as representing something else, a material object representing something, often something immaterial. That was true with the ark, right? The ark was a material object representing something immaterial. In this case, it was representing not only God's presence, but the covenant relationship that God had with Israel. It was a special relationship. It was represented by a material thing. Okay. What lesson was God hammering home? I think what God was hammering home here was the symbol is not the substance. A symbol points to substance, but a symbol is not the substance. To me, I think that's the main lesson. And having the symbol does not automatically equal having the substance. Okay. We're coming back to that after this chapter. Chapter 5, God defends himself. We get to see what happens post-battle. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. When the Philistines took the ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod arose early in the morning, there was Dagon, fallen on his face to the earth before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set it in its place again. And when they arose early the next morning, there was Dagon, fallen on its face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. The head of Dagon and both the palms of its hands are broken off on the threshold. Only Dagon's torso was left of it. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor any who come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. But the hand of the Lord was heavy on the people of Ashdod, and he ravaged them and struck them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how it was, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is harsh toward us and Dagon our God." Therefore they sent and gathered to themselves all the lords of the Philistines and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" And they answered, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be carried away to Gath." So they carried the ark of the God of Israel away. So it was, after they had carried it away, that the hand of the Lord was against the city with a very great destruction. And he struck the men of the city, both small and great, and tumors broke out on them. Therefore they sent the ark of God to Ekron. So it was, as the ark of God came to Ekron, that the Ekronites cried out, saying, "They have brought the ark of the God of Israel to us to kill us and our people." So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it go back to its own place, so that it does not kill us and our people." For there was a deadly destruction throughout all the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. And the men who did not die were stricken with the tumors. And the cry of the city went up to heaven. Okay. More tumult. So you see what's taking place here. The Philistines take the Ark of God from Ebenezer. Again, I see a bit of irony here. To this point, God has helped us. Who has he helped? It looks like he's helped the Philistines, right? Yeehaw, here we go. We got the trophy. Interestingly enough, they find out it's a trophy too big to showcase. You see that there in verses 2 and 3. I think it's written by the narrator as a very humorous piece. Here is this God of the Philistines, and he just can't help but fall down and show that he is worshiping. And what do? They take that guy and they set it back up. Oh, let's help our God out. Oh, wow. And then you have round two. Next morning, it's even worse. Heads off, hands off. Their God is just getting beat up all over the place. You'd think they'd just throw the God out and say, "Well, you know, he's really not able to take care of himself." No, that's not what happens. They make a superstition out of the whole thing. Ooh, his head landed on the threshold. Let's not ever step on the threshold again. That's what the devil does, doesn't he? He turns some of the goofiest stuff into crazy superstition. I was driving to work the other morning and all of a sudden a black cat ran across the roadway. And I had to laugh because I thought, boy, this would be a bad day for some people. Black cat crossed my path and I'm in for it now. We see in verses 6 to 12 that God's heavy hand descends. That's a reoccurring word throughout this chapter, is the hand of God. It is very heavy. And so we find them doing post-battle analysis too. What should we do? This is not turning out the way we had expected. People are dying. This is no trophy at all. This is a terror to us. Maybe it's regional. Okay, so apparently every one of those five Philistine towns had its own region with other towns. So let's just ship this thing off to the next region over. And of course, by the third time, the people of Ekron were going to have nothing to do with it. No way. Don't bring it here. No trophy to us. I had to think of, was it Brother Wilmer said yesterday, that God is not non-resistant. Well, he's definitely not non-resistant here. And he is showing himself very strong. All right, so I'd like us to come back to this thought of symbolism. Did God take symbolism seriously in the Old Testament? Yes or no? I believe he took it very seriously. You have the whole layout of the temple, the candlestick, the altar of incense, the table of showbread, and God had it laid out to the nth degree how those things were to be constructed. It wasn't left to chance or human intuition. And all of those things were prefiguring or foreshadowing things that were to come. So in the Old Testament, symbolism is a big deal to God. Do you think symbolism is a big deal to God in the New Testament? Did Jesus institute any symbolism, do you think? Yes? Any illustrations? Okay. Those would be, verbal symbolisms. Yeah, symbolism takes a lot of different forms. I'm thinking of material symbolism. Communion. That is a big one, isn't it? That is a very important one. That's one that probably virtually every church agrees. Yes. Communion is, it's symbolic, but it's a symbolism that Jesus put into place that we ought to continue. We might differ on how we exercise that symbol or how we represent it, but we still believe that it's what we should be doing. Another one. Feet washing. Yes, feet washing carries a very important symbol, but it points to something beyond just the material. There's a big one that we're overlooking that I think virtually most churches would agree on. The cross, okay. I wouldn't say that was necessarily instituted by Christ, but it is a powerful symbolism that speaks of what he did.
Baptism.
Baptism, yes. There's different ways of doing that, but everybody pretty much agrees it's something that should be observed. Okay. What about the holy kiss? What about short hair uncovered for men? What about uncut hair covered for women? We mentioned that the lesson for the Israelites, I believe, is the symbol is not the substance. That's an important thing to remember. The symbol is not the substance. Additionally, I believe the lesson for the Philistines was, at least one of them is, the substance is not divorced from the symbol. That was not just a box that they won on the battlefield. Have you ever heard someone make a statement, let's say about baptism, oh, that's just mere symbolism, or some other such thing? All that happens is a person gets wet. But what do they mean when they use the word mere symbol or mere symbolism? What do they typically mean by that? Okay, so yeah, it's not about the act itself, it's the meaning behind it. Oftentimes when I've heard it, it's a way of just completely separating symbol and substance. In other words, it's just something you do. I didn't feel any different when it happened to me or when I chose to do whatever it was. So mere symbolism is just, there's nothing really there. It doesn't point to anything beyond itself. It's not tied into anything of value or not value, but of reality. They might mean mere symbol or symbolism because they didn't get to decide how it should be shaped or worn or used. I wasn't a part of the planning committee, so that's just what they decided to do. I think you realize when you start thinking about it, life is actually made up of a lot of symbolism, more than we might think or realize. I have something to show you here. That is not my wife. That's just a picture of my wife. There's a guy who used to go around doing presentations. I don't know, quite a character. Anyway, he used to say that. And of course, everybody's, it's not his wife. Why is he with her in the picture? You think about it. Pictures are symbols, aren't they? They represent the reality that was. And we've got tons of symbols on our phones and in our digital cameras and our computers. But those symbols are not the reality. They just represent the reality. I'm illustrating what symbols do, how they work, how we engage with it. So, what if I didn't have a chance to vote on a certain symbol? Do I still have to submit to it? Shouldn't I have a say? Let's move this into the realm of representation or symbolism on the roadways. Okay, what's that? Traffic light, right? What's that? Stop sign. Okay, we all recognize a stop sign. Eight sides. It's got these letters, S-T-O-P. It's red with the white lettering. You know, in reality, what is a stop sign? Have you ever seen a stop? The stop sign just represents a stop, right? It's a symbol of a stop. I was going into town one time that was known to be quite heavily patrolled by a policeman that thought he owned the whole place. And so people just knew, hey, you don't go through New Berlin and break the speed limit or do anything that you shouldn't be doing. And there was a four-way stop right in the middle of town. And so I came up to the four-way stop. I was in college and I was borrowing my brother's car. And I came up to the four-way stop and I looked up the street and there's the policeman. I thought, well, okay, there's the policeman. And so I stopped and proceeded to make my right-hand turn. And he came after me, turned on his lights, pulled me over. I couldn't figure out what he was wanting. And he proceeded to tell me that I had not stopped at that four-way stop. Well, what was even worse is I didn't have my wallet with me. And, of course, the car is in my brother's name. Well, he was just really hopping mad. You know, I said I stopped. He said I didn't stop. And as I recall, I got a citation out of it. But, you know, policemen have the power to see a stop when they think they see a stop. You see, stop signs are shorthand. They're much more efficient than trying to hire a policeman for every crossroads and T. But just because it's not a person doesn't mean it doesn't have meaning or power. A stop sign at a T or a crossroads has power because it has the whole force of the United States government behind it. And I'm not free to just blow past that because I didn't get a say in it. You can imagine you get ticketed for not stopping and you try to argue your way out of it with the policeman. You say, well, I wasn't consulted about how we do these symbols. I don't believe in it. And you end up before the judge. What are you going to say? You know, I think stop signs should be configured differently. I don't like the color. I mean, there's nothing in natural law. You know, shouldn't you be able to tell from nature how things operate? You know, it's based on nature. There's nothing in nature that says that red automatically means stop. In fact, if you put it in front of a bull, it'd say go to him. So I think this thing's completely off kilter. We recognize that if we treat it as mere symbolism, at some point, we'll probably pay a price for that. I won't ask for any confessions about whether you try to use the acronym slide through on prayer or anything like that when you come to the stop sign, but we recognize that if we have not stopped and we are stopped, pulled over by the policeman, he has every right to dish out the consequences for us treating the sign as mere symbolism. All right, let's look at another sign. How many of you have seen a sign like that before with the black and yellow diagonal stripes on a long rectangular sign? Okay? Most everybody has. That's good. That means that you've been on some roadways. I'm pretty sure all of you have seen the sign, but maybe it just didn't click because you're not driving and it doesn't matter. But when it comes to driving and your driver's test, you may want to know what this stands for. Do you know what it's called? Anybody know what the sign is called? Well, I mean, if you don't know what it's called, how can you be expected to obey it? Do you understand it? I think some of you don't even understand it. If you don't understand it, how can you be expected to obey it? Okay, well, let's continue on with it. You've got two roadways here, and I'm going to put the sign two different ways. So one way, you have the diagonal stripes pointing down toward the roadway. You've got rocks up ahead on the right-hand side, and so you put the sign on the right-hand side, and the vertical stripes are pointing down toward the roadway. And the second, same illustration, roadway with rocks ahead, you've got the sign on the right-hand side as well, with the diagonal stripes pointing toward the rocks or toward the obstacle that is ahead. And we're going to take a vote here. And we're going to vote by standing. So you're going to stand for one or the other of these. How many of you would say that you think this left one here with the diagonal stripes pointed toward the road, that's the proper way? Stand. Okay. Kind of looking around. Is this the right one? Should I stand? Okay, you may be seated. Okay. How many of you would say, I'm assuming everybody else now, all rise, this one with the pointing toward the obstacle ahead, that's the one. You may be seated. Thank you. Actually, the minority was correct in this case. I have seen the signs misplaced before where the diagonal stripes point toward the obstacle, but 99% of the time, the way it's supposed to be is pointed toward the roadway. And I like to think of it as optimism because it's showing us where to go, not what the problem is. It's interesting, and I love Mexico, but one of the things that fascinates me is you go to Mexico, they do it the other way. Their diagonal stripes go down toward the obstacle, and to me that's pessimistic because you're constantly pointing out what's wrong with the roadway. Anyway, it's just a fun little thing to say. Whether we understand a symbol or not, whether we know what it means, it still has value or still has meaning, and we are expected to live by it, whether we had a vote on it or not. Okay? So, yeah. So let's move back to the spiritual realm here. Obviously, God has designed symbols or ordinances to give some substance to the supernatural. Oftentimes, the immaterial is the supernatural. I think there are two ways that we can get off track here with symbols. At least two ways. One of them is to hold the symbol but deny the substance. And I'll pick on the head covering because that's one of the easiest ones to think about. But if a sister just plopped the covering on her head because this is my protection, this will keep me. It says right there in 1 Corinthians 11, because of the angels, power on the head. So I am energized. I am charged. I've got it, you know. That is holding the symbol but denying the substance. That's what we see Israel having done with the ark. And this often leads to self-deception because we think that God is pleased when he's actually displeased, or we think that God is present when he's actually absent. Another way that we can get off the rails is to claim the substance while denying the symbol. This happens all the time. I mean, the first one happens all the time too, but people who do this, claiming the substance while denying the symbol, are frequently moving in a more progressive, that's a very nice way of saying, more liberal direction spiritually. And yet this action is really just a subtle form of disobedience. Whether we agree or not on a symbol, whether we understand it or not, whether we were a part of the original decision or not, the symbol really is representative. It's not for me to decide. If it's been instituted by God, by Christ, then it has meaning. It has value, and it is to be carried out materially, representing something immaterial or supernatural. I realize that people can misread our symbolism. People have thought my mom and sister were Catholics. They've done that to you probably as well. But that doesn't change the original intent that God has for a symbol. People might think you're going swimming. But if you're being baptized, it doesn't matter. It points to a reality of what God desires and delights in. So if God has ordained certain symbols and they really do represent reality, then it's impossible for them to be mere symbols. I want you to get a hold of this, that it is a fallacy. It is false to speak of something as a mere symbol in the sense that the symbol is just something separated from substance. Symbols do at least two things. One, they are descriptive. They tell us what ought to be. What ought to be. It's easy to understand that with road signs because they tell us what the reality should be. But they're not only descriptive, they're directional. They predict what we will become. If we move more into a general cultural setting here, the whole transgender idea did not arise from nothing. It didn't just suddenly appear in our world today. It began with something small, and I'm going to contest that it began with transgender symbolism. I'm not judging the people who do this. I'm making an observation of the direction that their choice has set in motion. When certain women decided it was okay to start wearing clothes that looked like men's, that was symbolic. It wasn't empty. It maybe didn't send the signal that they intended to send. Remember, we said that symbols can be misunderstood, or you know, people don't understand what's going on. But it did send a signal, and it set a direction. It led to indistinct clothing for the genders. So you can see that symbols really are descriptive and prescriptive. It's not really that big of a step to go from supposedly transgender clothing to a transgender body. I'm not arguing that clothing has a clear scriptural symbolism, other than we do have what Deuteronomy says, and we do recognize where it points and where it goes to. And I think we can learn from that. So symbols are extremely important. If somebody writes you off or your church off as practicing mere symbolism, ask yourself this question. Am I really practicing this or trying to practice this thing apart from the reality toward which it points? And if not, if you are truly exercising faith toward God, you know, I don't understand how cut hair uncovered honors my head, but I practice it in faith that that symbolism does what God says it does. I don't fully understand it, but I exercise faith in living out that symbolism. Now, I don't put my faith in this, but my faith goes through it to the God who has ordained it. So if you're walking in faith toward God, the God behind the symbolism, even though you don't understand all the ins and outs, be assured it is not mere symbolism. And further remind yourself that a symbol by its very nature has meaning because it represents something. If a symbol doesn't represent anything, it's not a symbol. That might sound strange, but that's the bottom line truth. A symbol is only a symbol if it actually does represent something. Therefore, it's false or it's a fallacy to speak of a mere symbol. There is no such thing. Symbols always point beyond themselves. We are not free to decide if God's symbols are applicable. We are only free to obey or disobey. In the kingdom economy, there are no such things as mere symbols. And what I like as I think about this in the context of the kingdom is we have definite symbols that God has given to us, but you can see the difference between the Old Testament symbols and the New. God was very specific with those, color and size and numbers and all of that. In the New, we don't have that, do we? And I think that's God saying, look, I care about it. It needs to happen. But you are free to decide how it happens as a church brotherhood, as a body of believers. And that gives us so much of the variety that we have today. So that we are practicing these things, not exactly alike, but we are all living out the symbolism that God has given to us. I have a feeling this raises some questions for some people. The question box awaits.